everyone. My name is Pascal Derry. I'm the Vice President of Communications at the Montreal Economic Institute. Today, our first podcast will address the most relevant topic since Donald Trump took office, free trade. For the first time in many years, in the context of our Ian Suttar lecture series, the MEI decided to hold a debate on this topical issue, featuring two great debaters, Dr. Tom Palmer, Executive Vice President for International Programs at the Atlas Network, and Dr. Rick Smith, Executive Director of the Broadband Institute. It is moderated by Dan Delmar, Managing Partner, Public Relations, TNKR. Vu que nos deux conférenciers invités sont anglophones, le débat a eu lieu uniquement en anglais, mais je vous invite à visiter notre site internet www.iedm.org pour jeter un coup d'œil à nos publications sur le libre-échange, mais aussi sur bien d'autres enjeux de politique publique. The debate is structured in three parts. First, the debaters will examine the pros and cons of free trade in general. Then, they will dive into issues surrounding the rise of the one man that is on everyone's minds and whether or not his trade policies are in the process of making America great again. Finally, it ends on a more solutions-oriented line of discussion in which they examine what free trade agreements should look like. I really appreciated the debate. I think it was a very constructive discussion. Both of the speakers defended their views with strong arguments. They obviously have different perspectives, but they do also share some common ground, which is very interesting. So I hope you enjoy. Bonsoir tout le monde. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for all being here tonight for this third edition of the Ian Suttar Lecture Series presented by Pembroke Management, the lead sponsor of this event tonight, which is represented tonight by Jan Etkin, managing partner of Pembroke, and Scott Taylor, chairman emeritus at Pembroke, who's at the head table. Thanks for being here tonight. We have the honor and the privilege as well. We have the honor and the privilege as well of having among us Elgi Suttar, Ian Suttar's wife, and their daughter, Annabelle Suttar, a successful theater producer. We're happy to have you tonight. Thank you. Thank you for your ongoing support. I also want to thank our season sponsors, Mandrake Vézina Lebeau, represented by its president, Normand Lebeau. Merci, Normand, d'être là. Ah, Normand, je te vois. BCA Research, represented tonight by Chris Bose, associate editor, U.S. Equity Strategy, here at the head table as well. Thank you, Mr. Bose, for being here tonight with us.
Good evening, everyone. Bonsoir, tout le monde. Tempted to say bonjour, hi, but maybe I won't do that. Thank you, Michel. Thank you to all your team at the Montreal Economic Institute for this interesting initiative. I'm all about a good debate, so I'm very excited about this evening. Thank you to Pembroke Management, the Suttar family as well, for what promises to be a really interesting evening. The topic up for debate tonight could not be more relevant. Free trade, of course, is top of mind now in geopolitics, from the election of Donald Trump to the renegotiation of NAFTA, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I'm sure will come up tonight, perhaps growing economic nationalism across Europe as well. How do we do business with each other? How do we do business with the other? All can be polarizing issues. What would the world look like with unlimited and absolute free trade? What would the world look like if there was decentralization and perhaps fewer foreign investment and foreign trade? We all have different views on tonight's issues, and I'm sure some of your concerns will be addressed by both our debaters tonight. Very different perspectives for Dr. Smith and Dr. Palmer, of course, but I think their positions you'll find to be nuanced, and I suspect we're going to wander onto some common ground, some surprising common ground this evening. The debate will be in three parts. We'll begin by examining the pros and cons of trade globally. Then we'll dive into issues surrounding the one man, I think, that is on everyone's minds tonight, and whether or not he is successfully making America great again. Finally, to end on a more solutions-oriented note, we're going to examine free trade deals and what they should look like to best to serve both the economy and our citizens and the planet. I'll quickly recap the rules of engagement. So audience members first, if you have any devices that are not on silent, please, if you mind, please do that. For each of the three blocks, the debaters will have 5 minutes to present their arguments, followed by two rounds, one of 2 minutes, the other of 1 minute. We'll keep the mood pretty calm tonight and mostly avoid crosstalk, so debaters have timers facing them on the stage down here, and if they go more than a few seconds over, I will crack the whip, gentlemen, so be careful, please. And that said, I'm going to bring up Dr. Palmer and Dr. Smith, and I wish everyone a pleasant debate. Bon débat tout le monde. So first I'll ask both presenters, beginning perhaps with Dr. Smith. Thank you for the embrace there. Just some quick opening comments before we get into the issue, and thank you for both being here tonight.
Thank you very much. I know you're all dying to hear from the guy from Broadbent. That's why I'm here. It is a pleasure to be here. As Michel says, I do disagree with virtually everything that the Montreal Economic Institute stands for. I believe that's why I'm here. I do think that perhaps we can agree on two things tonight, which is number one, that the last episode of Game of Thrones was completely awesome, which unites us all. And secondly, that the surely well-informed, spirited, collegial debate is the basis of good public policy. And so it's a pleasure for me to be here tonight. As Michel mentioned, the Montreal Economic Institute has provided sacrificial lambs, I mean participants, to Broadbent Institute debates in the past, and so I felt duty-bound to return the favor this evening. He actually phoned me up. He said, well, you know, you phone me a lot. Now it's time. You know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. So here I am. It's a pleasure to... Tom and I had a very pleasant beer last night, but... And we actually, I believe, may agree on some things tonight, but for the entertainment value, we will try to keep our areas of agreement to an absolute minimum this evening.
Dr. Palmer?
Well, just, it is such a pleasure, and I'm grateful to the Institut d'Économie de Montréal, which I admire tremendously, and they're active not only in Canada, but all across la Francophonie, and we always call on them, working with their friends in Niger and Senegal and other countries for good input, so I admire the Montreal Institute so much. It's also great to be back in Montreal, one of my favorite cities in the whole world. It's a great place. And I did offer, when they approached me, I said, I could do it in French. But they said, maybe not. Because the last time I gave a talk in French, in France, it was so emotional. There were tears of joy streaming down the cheeks of the audience. Many of them anticipated every word with flinches and gripping the arms of their chair. So we decided we would be presenting the whole thing in English. But I'm looking forward to an honest and serious conversation and not the cheap points that typically dominate so much political debate today, because these are important issues and they should engage all of us. And it was very good that Rick spotted me and dragged me over at the bar last night. We had a couple good Canadian beers together. So I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. Everyone ready? All right. Bon débat tout le monde. Let's begin. Let's begin with part one. Is free trade between nations, or should we say between the individuals who live in those nations, generally a good thing? Or are there more downsides than benefits? We'll start 5 minutes with Dr. Smith.
Thank you very much. Free trade is a terrible idea. Is the caricature of the progressive position on trade that is advanced by conservatives the world over. And I refuse to be made into a straw man tonight. I want to clarify at the outset that that no one, including me, is against trade in the sense of the exchange of goods and services between people and nations. This is surely beneficial to both parties. And the classical expression of this, of course, and I hesitate given the eminent economists in the audience, but I will venture into this historical territory. The classical expression, of course, of free trade was that of David Ricardo in the early 1800s, who had the counterintuitive insight that's come to be known as the theory of comparative advantage. And according to this theory, a country will produce more and consume less of a good for which it has a comparative advantage over another country. The counterintuitive insight being that this specialization will lead to greater prosperity for both parties. Now, this makes a lot of sense on paper. The mathematics are inarguable. And frankly, I do enjoy living in an economy, certainly in Canada, in the dead of winter, when we can receive lemons when it's very cold outside, and we can export maple syrup by the bucket load. But what I want to argue here, however, is that this idealized notion of free trade doesn't obtain in the real world with real-world trade agreements for three reasons. Number one, gains to the economy from specialization are not automatic. The Ricardian free trade model is just that. It's a model. It assumes full employment. It assumes a no international capital mobility, such that resources remain in the country they originated in and are efficiently reallocated when a country has a comparative advantage. These assumptions fall apart in the real world. The reality is that that even if there are overall gains, there will be winners and losers from liberalized trade. The losers are rarely compensated, and we all talk about doing this, but it never actually happens. So it has to be said that in reality, the winners and the losers are too often decided by which corporate interests have been successful in their lobby efforts, as opposed to erudite and dispassionate experts such as Dr. Palmer. My second argument is that outside of lemon trees and maple syrup and other natural endowments, the comparative advantage of a country is not God-given. It is constructed, often through government policy. One famous example of this, of course, is South Korea, that in the 1970s got up and running, basically from scratch, what is now the world's biggest shipbuilding industry. Countries that do well from more open trade tend to have active interventionist governments, such as China. They limit capital flows, and they often provide cheap credit to targeted sectors. Canada, under liberal trade, has seen a diminution of advanced industrial sectors and reinforced resource dependency. Until the recent collapse in prices, the resource sector accounted for the majority of our exports. Free trade has not, as promised, boosted productivity or our knowledge-based economy. Our advanced technology sector is far smaller, it's far less dynamic than the United States. Why? Because of the lack of an effective industrial development policy. This has to go hand in hand with trade liberalization. My third argument is that many modern trade agreements contain harmful provisions shoveled in there, shoehorned in there, that have nothing to do with trade. Ridiculous examples of this abound. My current favorite, and something I've done a lot of writing on, is the new Canada-US-Mexico trade deal that includes an entire detailed annex outlining a very poor standard for the regulation of the cosmetics industry. This has nothing to do with free trade. This has nothing to do with good policy. This is clearly the illicit fruit of some high-powered lobbying lunch. And this will result in real and measurable physical damage to Canadians. So in conclusion, the theoretical economic case for free trade does not always hold up in the real world of hypercapital mobility, of significant unemployment. To actually work, free trade agreements have to go hand in hand with robust national economic development plans, and they need to clearly place the public interest ahead of corporate rights.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. Very well timed as well.
Salvo.
Dr. Palmer, over to you for 5 minutes.
Well, thank you kindly. The answer to the question is yes. A more voluntary freedom to trade is a very, very good thing, and the small downsides are much, much smaller than the huge upsides. Now, of course, some trades are legitimately restricted, and they're not included under the umbrella of free trade because they involve unwilling participants and are therefore not free. So stolen goods may not legitimately enter the stream of commerce, the goods that are a product of forced labor, and so on. And all of the trade laws around the world, certainly in civilized countries, ban that. And that's certainly appropriate. What I'm talking about, what we're talking about, is trade in the normal commercial products that people buy and sell. Not only consumer goods we think about, but capital goods. And that's going to turn out to be very, very important because of the importance of global supply chains. Now, if you think about the opportunities for freedom of trade, I'm going to point out later, we'll discuss this question of the caveats about comparative advantage. I think the claims that were made were simply false. that you have to have full employment in a country. Both countries have to have full employment, and there's no mobility of capital factors. This comes out of right-wing extremist websites, Paul Craig Roberts, who's not a serious economist, and there's no serious economist who believes that. When we think about the freedom of trade to buy and sell, of course, there are losers as well. Anytime there are two voluntary participants in a trade, there may be third parties who lose because they lose the opportunity to be a participant. But think about the benefits that come from the freedom to make those decisions, to shop at this chain rather than that chain. When I shop here, the ones at that chain now lose my business. They're losers in that economic exchange. But we're all better off by having the freedom to make that decision. When we draw a line down a community where we have two grocery stores and suddenly we say, this is Metroville and this is Loblaw City, nothing changes. The principles of comparative advantage are still the same. The fact that we draw a line does not change the facts of economics. Regardless of whether factors are mobile within a country or across borders, the principles of comparative advantage of buying from others what they produce at lower cost than we produce it at is still good for us and it presents win-win situations. It's something Adam Smith noted many years ago. He said, every family, dealing with any family, one should never attempt to make at home what it will cost them more to make than to buy. What is prudence in the conduct of every private family can scarce be folly in that of a great kingdom. If a foreign country can supply us with a commodity cheaper than we ourselves can make it, better buy it of them with some part of the produce of our own industry, employed in a way in which we have some advantage. And history has shown that Smith's insight was spot on, and the protectionist fallacies have generally been discarded along the way. Now, there are some progressives who argue, well, anytime you have an inequality in income or something else, it's an unfree trade by definition, unequal bargaining power, and so on. And I think it's a fallacious argument. Jeff Bezos is much, 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 much richer than I am, but he's not freer. And if he and I were to be forbidden to engage in trade, it would not be good for me just because he's richer that I would not be allowed to trade with him. Trading with poorer people, in fact, is how they escape from poverty. Now, we agreed not to use PowerPoint, which is a little bit of a shame. I'm a PowerPoint guy, and I like to present data. And it is overwhelming, the gains from trade and the transformation in my lifetime in the world. The increase, if you think about going back to 1820, and per capita income, even not counting for increases in inequality, is at least 4,300% in wealthy countries like Canada and the US, and in the poorest countries of the world, it's at least 10 times the income, and that has been made possible by trade. Every credible study shows that the great bulk of the benefits of trade go to the poor and the middle classes. The rich do fine. They can afford to buy Canadian or buy American. It's poor people who benefit overwhelmingly from freedom of trade. In fact, the vast majority of people today don't work in tradable goods sectors. They're in service sectors and others. In the US, about 12% of wage earners are in the manufacturing sector, a few percent in agriculture, and all the rest are in services. Over the past 40 years, the increase in global supply chains has been simply astonishing. It's no longer the case that there are integrated, vertically integrated companies in one country anymore. These have largely disappeared. When we're talking about trade, it's not just consumer goods that compete with local producers, it's the capital inputs for the country's own manufacturing sector that are at stake here. In short, free trade is good. Unlike trade restrictionism, free trade is moral, it's smart, it's just, it is the path to human flourishing, liberation, and enlightenment, and I'm for it.
Thank you, Dr. Palmer. Dr. Smith, we'll go to you for a rebuttal for 2 minutes now.
It was suggested at the table at the outset that we vote at the end of this debate, but I deemed that unwise. I appreciate that argument, and certainly it's true that global liberalization has secured higher economic growth and greater prosperity in many developing countries, most notably China. But these countries, while following a model of export-led growth, also managed trade in the interests of national economic development. In a relatively short period of time, China has moved rapidly from production of unsophisticated goods based on cheap labor, such as clothing and toys, towards much more sophisticated goods, such as aircraft and high tech, seeking to directly challenge the US in its areas of strength. China has by far the most sophisticated high-speed rail network in the world and is the global leader in production of cheap solar power. Many other countries liberalized trade, but failed to launch successful national economic development paths. For instance, much of Africa and South America, these countries continue to be specialized producers of raw materials, and they continue to have very high levels of poverty. So my argument here this evening is that in the real world, free trade is, liberalized trade is inadequate to achieve some of the things that Dr. Palmer is suggesting. When we look at trade between the US and Canada, we see that the huge US advantage in many technologically advanced industries was based in significant part on active industrial development policies, especially support for military research and development in the US, the DARPA program. As the economist Mariana Mazzucato has shown, much of the early intellectual capital of Apple was developed through US government defense industry research spending. We need these kinds of policies in Canada to develop our own competitive advantages in advanced industrial sectors instead of pretending that leaving it all to some fictional, invisible market will do the trick.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. Dr. Palmer, 2 minutes, please.
Thank you. I already said it started. Okay, there we go. First point, I'm going to dispute the history of trade question. South Korea was not a state-led trade system. If you look at South Korean economic development and economic growth, it's flat until they joined the GATT. It's when they began to open up their markets after joining the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs that you see the uptick in economic activity in Korea. So I don't think that's the case. This is a common myth that mercantilists spread. If you look at China, Shen Hong did a very important study, the argument that it's the state-subsidized industries or the parastatal industries that are the crown jewels, which is what Xi Jinping says. And what Shen Hong looked into the data, he said, once you count in the implicit subsidies, they pay less than half the market price for electricity, they get subsidized credit from state banks, they get free rent, and on and on and on and on, subsidized oil, and so on. Once you factor in the implicit subsidy, all of those crown jewels are money-losing enterprises in the Chinese economy. That's not a surprise. This is where all the princelings inhabit. This is cronyism writ large. I don't think you want that in Canada, frankly, to have Chinese-style cronyism, which is apparently what is on the menu. These are actually harmful to the economy and drag down the productive parts of the Chinese economy or any other. But with regard to Africa, there's been almost no trade liberalization in Africa. This is just not the case. Africa has the highest restrictions on trade across border in the world. So the idea that Africa is an example of a failure of free trade policies is puzzling when it's the most protectionist sector in the world, most protectionist economy.
Okay, thank you very much. Final round is 1 minute, so good time to get a jab in on the final topic.
He finished early. Does that mean I get his time?
Unfortunately
you may.
Not.
No, okay.
All right, so 1 minute.
Go ahead. to reiterate, trade is in the everyday meaning of the word is something that we endorse, something that I endorse. Trade can be a good thing, but trade policy has to be part of a broader national economic development policy. Other nations, including conservatives in other nations, understand this. I wanted to inject one final belated thought. Another economic revolution is upon us, propelled by the realities of climate change. The World Resources Institute estimates that the potential market for clean technologies in the developing world alone is US $2.5 trillion through 2022. That's a big number. And there are big opportunities for investors and entrepreneurs when it comes to the necessary new technologies to combat climate change. No nation, this is a new challenge. No nation starts off with a 19th century David Ricardo style comparative advantage in this new and developing area. The successful economic actors of the future will be those countries that plan for it, as opposed to leaving it to some fictional market.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. And last minute for Dr. Palmer.
I agree entirely on the question of managed trade, and that is not what I'm defending, and we have a fair amount of that cronyism, and the people who have their lobbyists make sure they get a little passage in there that favors their firm. I would defend trade deals that have less of that and more liberalization as on balance improvements, but I don't defend those carve-outs look at even intra-Canadian trade. 140 pages of the Canada Free Trade Act of 2017 is exceptions. So this is not really a free trade arrangement, even within the Canadian provinces. But I would like to point out how important human capital is, and this is something I didn't hear, comparative advantage just based on natural resource endowments. This is a fantasy. I don't understand why that position is being held up. There are all kinds of advantages, and human capital is one. And yes, it is responsive to the investments in the educational system. I don't deny that at all. But the idea that it's not a form of comparative advantage would be laughed out of court in India right now.
Thank you, Dr. Palmer. Okay. Let's move on to part two. Well done, gentlemen. This part is the Trump part. Generally speaking, the question is, have President Trump's trade policies been good for Americans? And should other countries follow a similar approach? Let's begin with Dr. Palmer for 5 minutes, please.
Well, Mr. Trump has initiated a number of policies, some of which I think have had beneficial effects, but trade is not on the list. Scrapping NAFTA for the authentically, idiotically named USMCA, which he insisted US was first and United States Marine Corps, is in the best case a very marginal improvement over the current arrangement, in the best case, but with a downside, it might not pass the three legislatures, so there's a great risk involved. My friend from Mexico, Roberto Salinas León, recently called it not NAFTA 2.0, but NAFTA 0.7. due to its negative impact on the automotive industry, which has a huge continental supply chain that generates a lot of value for people in three countries, Canada, United States, and Mexico. Trump's flagrant abuse of trade law to designate Canada a national security threat, yes, it's true. Whenever I think of threats to the national security of the United States, Canada immediately springs to mind. It's shameful and disgraceful, in my opinion, and I'm ashamed to hear that kind of language. The tariffs on aluminum and steel imports are already harming multiple industries and consumers in the United States. The restrictions on imports on China have a major negative impact on the U.S. economy, including the agricultural sector. The few jobs allegedly protected by the president's restrictionist policies have come at enormous cost, both in terms of loss of jobs in other industries. That's very important. You protect this job at the expense of destroying this other job, but no one sees that. But also pure deadweight losses for the economy as a whole. The study of the Trump tariffs on washing machines that came out just about 3 days ago from three economists at Chicago and the Fed pointed out it brought in $82 million in revenue, which Trump was very happy about, $82 million. But it already cost consumers over $1.5 billion in additional prices paid because washing machines and dryers have gone up in price, big surprise. At most, 1,800 jobs have been protected in the washing machine industry, so at a cost of only $815,000 per job. When President Trump campaigned for office, he said, quote, "We're going to win so much, you're going to be sick and tired of winning." And he was right. If that's winning, I'm sick and tired of it. So no, Trump's trade policies have not been good for the people of the United States, nor good for the people of the world. That any country that would adopt them would be leaping into the same dumpster fire that Trump has fueled with piles of alternative facts, ignorance, and arrogance. Now, you might ask, what's the basis for his trade policy? Well, that was asked by his chief economic advisor, Gary Cohn. He said, "Mr. Trump, why do you believe these things?" The answer, "I just do. I've had these views for 30 years. In a radio interview last March, Cohn said, "I knew I was losing the war on tariffs. I knew I wasn't going to convince him I was right. I was not going to take a 74-year-old man who's believed something since he was 30 and convince him that I was right." That's the basis of our trade policy. I just do. What about the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross? On August 4, 2016, he wrote an angry letter to the Wall Street Journal, which had criticized Trump. He said, "It's Econ 101. That GDP equals the sum of domestic economic activity plus net exports, i.e. exports minus imports. Therefore, when we run massive and chronic trade deficits, it weakens our economy." It would be difficult to write two more ill-informed sentences than those two from our Secretary of Commerce. He thinks that the accounting identity that defines gross domestic product, consumption plus investment plus government plus exports minus imports, is an equation of economic growth. And if you diminish imports, you increase GDP. This is not the case. It's an accounting identity. And the reason why you subtract imports is they're already counted in consumption, investment, and government. So you don't want to double count them. Well, a policy based on such unbelievable, unconquerable ignorance cannot turn out well. And indeed, it has not. Now, finally, there is much more at stake than just economic well-being. Trump said, trade wars are good and easy to win. They're not good and they cannot be won. They generate losers on all sides. The best defense I've heard was, the Chinese are being hurt worse than we are. That's the new Trump standard. Really? Seriously? I start a fight with you, I'm mortally wounded, but you die first, and I win. Trade makes people mutually dependent, and this is important. Trade causes peace, and protectionism is the road to war. And that is one of the reasons I fear this president very much.
Thank you, Dr. Palmer. Defending Donald Trump tonight.
Yeah. All right.
5 minutes.
Even I felt like clapping for him, and that's a problem because this is a debate, right? So,
Dr. Smith, 5 minutes.
Thank you.
We'll give you back those 10 seconds.
Give me back my.
We will.
Okay, please, please. I'm a Canadian. Please. Okay, there we go. I think we can agree that Trump. Certainly, I agree that Trump's policies have been extremely damaging for Canada, for other countries, and even the U.S. itself. Many of my arguments have been stolen. Trump's tariffs have hit the steel, aluminum, and forest industries. He's put a new chill on investment in Canada out of fear of loss of market access. I mean, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has been extremely eloquent on the damaging impacts of Trump's tariffs in terms of depriving U.S. industry of necessary things like lumber to build in the United States. These policies are driven by simplistic right-wing populism in constant search of the other. And actually, it was a privilege to actually watch Dr. Palmer. He's got a great YouTube video where he's very eloquent about this, talking about how Trump's in the business of creating the other. The Mexicans, the Canadians, you know, the foreigners, right? These vitriolic, whimsical outbursts on trade have a corrosive effect, of course, not just in the economic sphere, but on the relationship between nations. Do any of us feel like the world is a more peaceful or stable place because of Donald Trump's policies? Of course we don't. What I do want to do here, in an attempt to disagree with my colleague, is to diagnose what is driving, what is the source of Donald Trump's power. And I want to suggest here that today's trade-denying right-wing populism is an understandable outcome of an extreme free trade agenda. Trump's policies are a reaction against liberal globalization and corporate trade deals. He speaks to real grievances of those who view themselves as victims of these deals. We may not agree with his methods, but the grievances that he's trying to engage with are real. He won because of narrow victories in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, places that Democrats have traditionally won in the past. From 2000 to 2011, U.S. manufacturing jobs as a percentage of total employment declined by over 4%. Over roughly the same period, Canadian manufacturing jobs declined from a high of 2.3 million to 1.7 million today. Many of these jobs moved to other countries. Now, I don't want to just recount bloodless statistics here. I work for Ed Broadbent, so of course I want to talk about Oshawa, Ontario, where General Motors, as you know, announced the closing of a plant that has existed there for over a century. And so we're talking about a multi-generational way of life disappearing because of a press release. Last November, in the ensuing news coverage after GM's announcement, I was really struck on the day. I actually talked to my wife and I were watching the news that night. The most angry, supportive political voice on either side of the border voicing the concerns of GM workers was not the Conservative Premier of Ontario. It was not the Liberal Prime Minister of Canada. It was Donald Trump, who was shaking his fist, pounding his desk. He was talking about how he was going to call the GM CEO on the carpet in the Oval Office. No wonder his message is resonating. The economic angst that Canadians and Americans are feeling isn't restricted to localized plant shutdowns, such as Oshawa. Whether you measure income or wealth, more Canadians are feeling pinched. I mean, what some of you may have seen the study that came out a couple of weeks ago showing that almost a half of Canadians are concerned at any given time that they are $200 away from personal bankruptcy. If you look at wealth, the bottom 50% of income earners in this country own only about 5% of the wealth in this country. Now, am I suggesting that this state of affairs is solely related to trade policy? Of course, I am not. But the point that I'm making is that in this climate of economic anxiety, when the rich are getting richer and the majority of Canadians are feeling stuck or worse, any public policy, including trade policy, that pays insufficient attention to the needs of workers in the here and now is headed for the political rocks. Since 2000, there has been a precipitous drop of Canadians who tell pollsters that they regard themselves as middle class. Trump is feeding on this same anxiety in the United States. Is he offering a coherent alternative? No, of course he's not, and Dr. Palmer has convinced me on that score. At this moment, his only appeal to voters is that he's on their side. But that's enough, because the proponents of things like free trade agreements have given every indication that they are not.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. And 2 minutes to Dr. Palmer.
On the question of what has driven the rise in populism, it's something that I've been very deeply interested in for the last couple of years. I read a lot on populism, political history, literature and authoritarianism, and so on. One of the most striking features is Britain in Brexit. People made comparisons between the Trump movement and the Brexit movement. But the Brexit movement was not driven by hostility to trade. Indeed, many of the Brexit leaders were strong free traders, like Dan Hannan, who said, we'll have better trade deals, we'll have more trade, we won't be locked into the EU. Trade did not drive that. Immigration did. And I think there is an immigration issue that comes up. And this is what Trump plays on with his Mexican rapist comments and so on, in very vulgar ways. I think immigration is much more of a driver. And the fear of those others changing my neighborhood, making me speak Spanish, and so on. And that's a separate question, and it needs a lot of thought on how to address that with a liberal, in the big sense of the term, liberal response that will maintain our free institutions. But I don't think that trade is the key driver in this. Now, one of the other points is that when you look at the decline in percentage of employment going to manufacturing, value continues to go up, salaries and wages go up, and most of it is driven by automation, not by trade. This has been established over and over again. Automation, if you really are worried about that, tell people to stop inventing new stuff. Blow up all the laboratories and execute the technological innovators, because that's what's driving most of this. It's not outsourcing. Finally, one of the key problems is that when you protect jobs, in that sense, you're protecting low-wage jobs at the expense of high-wage jobs. What trade has done to the extent it has destroyed jobs, it destroys low-wage jobs to make place for high-wage jobs. This is, again, demonstrated in the data, and it's also demonstrated for good reason theoretically, which we talked about earlier about comparative advantage. You go to where you're adding the greatest amount of value. So protecting jobs in that way is a mistake. I wanted to be a typewriter repairman when I grew up. My dreams were dashed by heartless capitalism. But now I have a computer, and I'm better off.
Thank you. Over to Dr. Smith for 2 minutes.
I, too, am in favor of computers. I want it on the record. I'm not sure what that has to do with our debate. I'm glad you brought up Brexit, and I disagree. I mean, who voted in favor of Brexit? It wasn't people in the city in London. It wasn't the Scots who were doing pretty well in Edinburgh. It was a lot of folks in declining manufacturing centers, and a backlash against liberal economics was definitely part of the Brexit vote. We can go further into Europe. The Front National in France, the Italian right wing that opposes the European integration project. Again, my argument is not that all of these economic ills can be hung on liberalized trade. What I'm saying is that the advocates of liberalized trade have, to a certain extent, brought this on all of us because of a persistent inattention to the losers of free trade deals who are disposed to kind of get on with it. And it turns out that that's easier said than done. I think the lesson here is that if we want liberalized economies, we also have to make sure that people are protected through good social programs and public services, and that high labor standards are also maintained. The center, and I will own some of this, including the center left, certainly the center right, have gone astray when we've lost sight of the reality that many are being left behind from these changing economic models. And they need to be better taken care of. As Canadians, I mean, part of the question here is do we want to emulate Donald Trump? I think it's clear that we do not. But as Canadians, I am confronted some days by the sense that we're being pushed around. And so I do want to argue here that in the face of Donald Trump for the next little while, we may have to take some pages out of his playbook. How about we promote more rather than less use of cheaper generic drugs to lower the cost of our public health care system? If he persists in not putting a price on carbon, and we have a national carbon price,
thank you.
Surely having some border adjustments to compensate for that is in order.
Thanks, Dr.
So we
Smith.
Do need to make some adjustments.
Okay, 1 minute on Donald Trump to end this round. Dr. Palmer.
Some of these last things that were pointed up, I don't have a strong opinion on them, whether they're good or bad policy. They're just not connected to trade. And that's what I'm interested in debating here, is whether trade restrictions will make Canadians or Americans or anyone else better off or worse off. I think that the evidence is overwhelming that they'll be worse off. Let me mention one other thing, though, that is a constant feature that we have to address over and over and over. Trade deficits are bad. Donald Trump keeps telling us that. He says that we lost $817 billion trading with the Chinese. What a grotesque misunderstanding of international trade accounting. And it's something that needs to be addressed over and over again. It means you have a capital account surplus. It means that foreigners are investing in your economy. They're buying shares and assets because trade is always in balance. And this demonization of foreigners for buying our assets, in other words, investing in our economies, is nuts. And I think it's extremely dangerous as well. And there's a fundamental point of trade literacy that's important. And that's why I'd like to make a small gift about comparative advantage. Paul Krugman's essay, What Do Undergraduates Need to Know About Trade, which I recommend sharing with your colleagues.
Thank you. Can you autograph that for me?
I will. Now keep
Thank
it for
you,
now.
Dr. Palmer.
Okay, all right. All right, there we go.
And Dr. Smith for 1 minute, please.
Trump and his allies don't just threaten our economy, they threaten our democracy. But we need to be honest about the source of his success. Trump supporters aren't imagining the fact that the economy isn't working for them. And voters who have become convinced that an economy, that a global trading system are rigged against their interests, become susceptible to authoritarian and hateful messages. My argument is that the real-world consequences, as opposed to the theoretical aspects of free trade agreements, are coming back to bite us. And we have to make changes to this market fundamentalism model that downplays the positive role of government in the economy and society. The simple fact is that an increasing number of voters in the U.S., across Europe, here in Canada, as we head into a federal election, see things like free trade agreements as being adverse to their interests and to those of their families. If such agreements are to be at all politically saleable in the future, this needs to be fixed.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. Okay, final round. We're all ready for this last one. 5 minutes again each for opening statements. And the question is, should free trade agreements include environmental, labor, regulatory, and human rights norms and conditions? Let's begin with 5 minutes to Dr. Smith, please.
Thank you. My answer to this question is yes, absolutely. There should be these kinds of protections. In a so-called free market, success in trade competition is largely determined by costs. And there needs to be a fair floor to these kinds of costs. Respect for labor rights should not be seen as protectionist. Simply insisting that workers have the right to form unions and bargain does not establish a definite wage threshold. While neither China nor Mexico, as two examples, should be obliged by other countries to raise wages, they should be obligated to respect basic human rights. In the context of trade agreements, this would include the right to an independent union and the right to bargain collectively. These rights have been entrenched in international human rights conventions, and they are part of international law. Labor rights are human rights. And in fact, the right to an independent trade union is the only right found in both the UN Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. However, labor rights are manifestly not respected in places like Mexico and China, which suppress truly independent trade unions. This has been well documented by international human rights and labor associations. In fact, when China ratified the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, it announced that it just simply wouldn't honor Article 8, thus enabling its denial of workers' rights. The repression of these basic rights not only leads to exploitation of their own workers, it also gives China and Mexico an artificial advantage in trade, over and above their legitimate advantage as relatively low-wage countries. After more than 20 years in NAFTA, Mexican wages in manufacturing still average just over $2 US an hour. They've gone up about 1% a year. An advantage in trade should never be obtained by the denial of rights. The same can be said of environmental standards. Even conservatives in this country, including Jason Kenney, Premier Jason Kenney, now agree that charging industries some sort of output carbon levy makes sense. Imports should be required to pay an equivalent charge so we don't lose production and jobs. Because climate change is an existential threat, we need to do everything we can to transition to a carbon-free economy as soon as possible. I mean, the UN tells us that we have 12 years to inflect that carbon curve. Why shouldn't we be able to use procurement and national sourcing as a part of a strategy to create green jobs? In a famous recent example, the WTO struck down the Ontario Green Energy Act, which was a very important statute to move us from coal-fired to renewable power, as having a discriminatory provision favoring Ontario jobs. The Bilcon Company of Delaware is demanding currently that the Canadian government pay $300 million US in damages under Chapter 11 of NAFTA, after an environmental assessment panel rejected the company's plan to build a quarry and marine terminal. Unfortunately for the company, this would be located in an environmentally sensitive area of Nova Scotia, which is full of endangered species. A report released this week by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives found that Canadian investors have initiated at least 43 investor-state dispute claims against non-North American countries, with almost 70% of these claims regarding resource management and environment policies. While Canadian investors don't win many of these cases, they place significant stress on poorer countries' environmental policies and others implemented in the public interest, particularly for nations with smaller budgets and in greater fiscal instability. Some of the cases put forward by Canadian investors are built on rather tenuous grounds, but the low risk and the high reward of winning a case in front of these tribunals makes it a worthwhile endeavor, which results in administrative costs shouldered by these poorer countries. These sorts of worrisome examples show that we desperately need international norms for environmental protection. And at a minimum, the trade rules shouldn't be getting in the way. Bill Clinton said a few, proponent of free trade when he was president, said a few years ago, he acknowledged the errors of his administration in relegating such concerns to legally weak side agreements. He said, "I think it was a mistake. I think it was part of a global trend that was wrong-headed. And I couldn't agree more."
Thank you. 5 minutes, Dr. Smith. Sorry, Dr. Palmer.
Thank you. Well, as I mentioned in the opening statement, free traders strongly believe the products of forced labor should not be allowed to enter into the stream of commerce. But I also mentioned that being poor is not the same as being less free. And imposing the regulatory standards, labor standards, and environmental standards of wealthy countries on people in poor countries as a condition for trading with them means that they will just stay poor. And that's morally indefensible. Trade is central to lifting people out of poverty. The fact is that with regard to labor standards, health, education, child labor, environmental standards, and other matters, trade has made the world better. The most recent International Labor Organization 2019 report came out about a month ago on world employment demonstrated between 1993 and 2018, the share of people in low and middle income countries working in extreme poverty, $1.90 a day per capita of consumption, has dropped from almost 42% to less than 10% in that short period of time. Over 600 million people moving out of poverty. Most of them went from subsistence farming into paid work, which entailed access to health care and educational and other benefits. And moreover, it was not a shift from idyllic farm life, the vision that some people have, how wonderful it is. I've lived on farms. It's not clean or nice. They didn't go from idyllic farm life into satanic mills and sweatshops. In fact, just the share of industrial employment in those low and middle income countries did not change during those years, because almost all the growth in employment took place in retail, construction, services, and other sectors. And during that time, inflation-adjusted real wages more than tripled in those countries. Moreover, looking at just between 2000 and 2016, child labor, children between the ages of 5 and 17 engaged in labor, fell dramatically by 94 million, and it continues to fall year by year as family incomes rise, and that is the key. Not because someone in Ottawa or Washington told them to do that. When incomes rise, people move their children from the field into the school. And we should be encouraging more trade, which means rising incomes, which means more children being able to do that. We should not stop the process by making trade conditional on requiring that the poor already be rich in order to be able to trade with us. Lant Pritchett of Harvard University put it very neatly. Mostly in the world, there aren't poor people. There are people in poor places. We see this when people move from Haiti to the United States or Canada, and within a few years have an income that's a giant multiple of what they had earned back at home. It's not my fault if I was born in a poor country, and making it harder to trade with me does not make my life any better. It's a violent imposition of harm on poor, marginalized people that perpetuates their poverty. I should add, though, when it comes to environmental standards, a case could reasonably be made that when there are external effects, there should be some measure to rectify the externality. And I have in mind cases such as the plastic pollution, polluting our oceans, which is coming not from Canada, by the way, despite all the bans on straws, but from Africa and Southeast Asia, overwhelmingly. It's a real externality. It really does affect us all. And they justify a response, but not protectionism. What they need are policies to decrease the propensity of people to toss their plastic into rivers, deltas, and into the ocean. And protectionism or labor standards or others will not do that. They need rising income, so they will value the environmental amenities more. We see that with the inverted U curve on pollution all around the world. And possibly even subsidies or aid to help them deal with this problem, but not protectionism. Because if we do that, the oceans will just continue to fill with plastic. And finally, imposing minimum wages on poor people, as the USMCA does with regard to Mexican automotive workers, is not helping them. It's merely pricing them out of the market. It's unemploying those people. It's much better to be employed at $7 an hour than unemployed at $15 an hour. That's a pretty easy thing to understand. The same is true of other labor amenities, which we take for granted, but are the consequence of rising labor productivity and rising wages, which are taken in the form of better workplace environment and so on. I spend most of my time in very, very poor countries and not in wealthy countries like Canada. And I can tell you that people want to trade and that the restrictions on their trade keeps them poor. Let me end with a quote from a famous progressive trade analyst. With America's high standard of living, we cannot successfully compete against foreign producers because of the lower wages and lower cost of production. That was Herbert Hoover when he urged Congress to pass the Smoot-Hawley tariff that crashed the world economy.
Thank you. Dr. Smith, you have 2 minutes now for rebuttal.
I want to respond to this notion that free trade has lifted all of these masses out of poverty and, you know, provided ponies for all the children, or I don't know what. But free trade is not a panacea for the world's ills. In fact, Dr. Palmer, I'm sure, knows that fully 70% of global citizens recently lifted out of extreme poverty have happened in China. And as I've already argued, there's a whole host of other policies that have gone into that over and above free trade. So it's not just that free trade has done this, that is incorrect. Trade rules shouldn't trump needed regulation in the public interest. But trade deals usually require us to regulate in a way that minimizes the impact on trade. And this undermines the precautionary principle. In a famous example, the EU had to insist on specific provisions to block beef imports injected with hormones, which is a legitimate precautionary standard, but these ran afoul of WTO rules. I think we need either high international standards on environment and product safety, or protection of the right of national governments to set high standards as they see fit. My argument is not, as Dr. Palmer just suggested, that wages should be the same in developing and developed countries. My argument is that workers in developing countries should have the right to form unions and bargain with their employers to raise wages in line with growing productivity, and that those rights should be baked into the trade agreements, not relegated to some toothless side agreement that is unenforceable, that is often forgotten, that gathers dust on a shelf. Surely, if these trade agreements pay such attention to corporate rights and all sorts of involved tribunals, there can be the same attention in the trade agreements to environmental standards and to labor rights. The key point is that the rules governing global trade have to set out space for legitimate regulation, especially in the areas of labor and environmental standards.
Thank you. 2 minutes for Dr. Palmer.
Oh, thank you. Well, I agree that trade is not a panacea, and that's because nothing is a panacea. There are lots of problems in the world, and they require different solutions and medications. But trade makes things better. So I will set aside our disagreement on China, and I recommend going to the evidence and looking at the role of the state in the Chinese economy, which has not had the generally positive impact that Rick thinks it has. Well, let's look at India. Over 350 million people lifted out of the most grinding poverty you can imagine. Into a middle-class lifestyle with a motorcycle, a home, kids in school, and so on. This was not because of state-driven enterprise. And look at the Dalits. So in India, they used to be called untouchables. It's now considered a nasty term. But Dalit people were the absolute bottom of the pile. And after 1991 and the opening to international trade, there are now Dalit chambers of commerce. There are Dalits who serve on boards of universities that they would never have been allowed to enter. Had a Dalit shadow fallen on the shadow of the rector university, he would have been beaten senseless. And now, because they're wealthy through the market and through the access to international trade, which was the key for the Dalit people, they are now achieving respect and recognition as human beings, which they lacked before. So this is not because of clever trade subsidies from the Indian government. This is because of trade. Now, when it comes to WTO rules and so on, we should be very careful about something. There's no WTO army. They can't nuke you. There's no black helicopters, contrary to what Pat Buchanan thought, that will swoop in. It means there's an arbitrary mechanism that merely makes a finding that this law was in violation of the treaty that you signed. And as a consequence, another country could initiate a trade action that would therefore not be a violation. That's it. That's the extent of it. They don't haul you off or put you into country prison or anything like that. This is a means for adjudicating disputes. It is not a violation of sovereignty. Countries can continue to have the policies that they want domestically. There is a consequence to be paid if they signed an agreement did not allow those. But the only consequence is some other country raises the tariff on their goods.
Thanks, Dr. Palmer. Okay, it's our final round now, 1 minute each. If anyone wants to land any big blows, now is the time. 1 minute to Dr. Smith.
Or if the audience wants to heckle, now is the time. What we're witnessing, both on the political right and the political left, is a wholesale dissolution of public support for free trade. We should see this as an opportunity to press reset and to do things differently. There must be boundaries to protect important public interests, and we need some international rules to constrain bullies from the very beginning of negotiating these agreements, because the problem often starts in the initial design, which is largely opaque to the public. It's heavily influenced by cash-flush corporate lobbies, strong-arm tactics of the more powerful and aggressive nations. The rules become rigged, and once they're in place, the imbalances embedded in the original design do real-world damage to our ability as societies to make democratic choices about the world that we want to live in. If we made what is currently called free trade truly free, that is, freeing for workers, freeing us from damaging pollution, and freeing for our democracy, I would be all for it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Smith. And last words, Dr. Palmer, for a minute.
Well, I appreciate the endorsement of free trade.
Conditionally.
I think that it's important to bring up something that's quite significant, and that is, it's puzzling to blame free traders for there now being opposition to free trade, because free trade has enriched all the countries that have embraced those policies, whether they're in Europe or North America or elsewhere. And yes, there is a populist backlash. This worries me tremendously. I don't think trade is the key to it, and the Brexit example, I think, is such a powerful counterexample. I think that there are other forms of anxiety that are rising. Let me give you a simple example. Looking at the United States, U.S. labor market mobility is the lowest it's ever been since they began to gather these statistics going back to the 1920s. Why is that? It's not because of trade. Something else is happening, and I don't know the answer why. Changes in labor policies, unemployment compensation, disability, long-term disability is peaking in the U.S. I don't know why, but none of that is because of trade. Something else is happening, and it's a mistake to just blame trade so easy for problems that need a serious diagnosis.
Thank you so much, Dr. Palmer, Dr. Smith. That concludes the debate for this evening. You both performed admirably.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well done, gentlemen.
This has been a production of TNKR Media. Good talk.